From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Many of the results are in from yesterday's elections around the country. In Virginia, Democrats took control of the state legislature for the first time in decades. In Mississippi, Republican Lieutenant Governor Tate Reeves won the governor's race against Democrat Jim Hood by just over 5 percentage points. And the governor's race in Kentucky remains too close to call. The Republican incumbent Matt Bevin has refused to concede after his challenger, the state's Democratic Attorney General Andy Beshear, declared victory last night.
I haven't had an opportunity yet to speak to Governor Bevin, but my expectation is that he will honor the election that was held tonight, that he will help us make this transition. And I tell you what, we will be ready for that first day in office, and I look forward to it.
Joining us now is Ryland Barton, State House reporter for Kentucky Public Radio. Hi, Ryland.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Bevin still hasn't conceded the race. Last night he cited unspecified irregularities in the election. What are you hearing from his campaign and the state Republican Party? Is he going to formally challenge the results?
We haven't heard anything from him yet. It's still left at that claim of irregularities, which we know nothing about. The one thing is the Republican president of the state Senate raised the possibility of a recount of the election and even possibly an election contest. We don't have automatic recounts in Kentucky. That would have to that would be up to the governor, the governor's campaign to request that. But then election contest is kind of a crazy process where the result of the election would ultimately be determined by the legislature. And something like that hasn't happened in Kentucky since 1899.
Hmm. Well, when you look at the numbers, with 100% of precincts reporting, Beshear had a lead of just over 5,000 votes out of more than 1.4 million cast. When you look at the turnout, it was up quite significantly, up to 42% over 31% when Governor Bevin was elected in 2015. Do we know why?
I think that there are just a lot of people who are interested in this election. And actually, you know, it goes on both sides. There are more people who are voting for the governor. There are more people voting for Democratic Attorney General Andy Beshear, who, you know, got more votes in this election. I think there is just a lot of interest in this. So there are a lot more people who are paying attention. And, you know, there was a lot of a national attention on this race as well. We had President Trump come in just on the eve of the election to try and lend a helping hand to Governor Bevin at the last minute.
And President Trump said in a tweet that Bevin picked up at least 15 points in the last few days with Trump's help. Is that true? Was he down that far?
Yeah, nobody has seen a poll that showed Bevin that far behind ahead of the election. I certainly haven't. This election was widely considered to be neck and neck for a really long time. Granted, we didn't have a lot of public polling in this race. We had two polls conducted by the same polling firm nearly a year apart, frankly, and it showed Bevin actually coming back from about an 8-point deficit from last December to a neck and neck tie just ahead of the election. So we weren't sure if either candidate were, you know, ahead. Both of them are certainly fighting and acting like this is an incredibly close race, especially with Governor Bevin, who got tons and tons of help from the White House and from President Trump and surrogates who came out to try and buoy his campaign.
What would you say were the most important issues for voters in this election?
I think that health care is a really big issue. Governor Bevin's attempts to reshape Kentucky's Medicaid system. This is the work requirements that you hear a lot about. He wanted to require most beneficiaries to prove that they're working or in school in order to keep their benefits. Education is obviously a huge issue. Teachers protested Governor Bevin's policies over, you know, trying to basically reshape the state's pension system and weaken pension benefits for future state workers. Teachers descended on the state capitol by the thousands to protest those policies, as well as a lot of education funding issues and charter schools. Teachers were a huge factor in this race. They really flexed their muscle.
And tell us about Beshear, who could well be the next governor of Kentucky.
Sure. Beshear is the son of Bevin's predecessor, former Governor Steve Beshear. He's been the attorney general for the last 4 years. He spent much of his time in office suing Governor Bevin over a lot of his policies. Granted, Governor Bevin had really Made a lot of efforts to kind of push executive power in the state. And I think that having this relationship of a Republican governor and a Democratic attorney general at the same time made for some very interesting and fractious situations. He sued over the governor's pension policies. Most famously, ended up getting struck down by the state Supreme Court. That was, you know, a big rallying cry once again for teachers and other state workers who really didn't like the governor's stance on that. But yeah, he says that he's going to stop the governor's plans to reshape Medicaid, and he's going to try and boost funding for public education. He wants to do that by legalizing casino gambling in Kentucky, which the fully Republican-led legislature says is going to be a non-starter.
That is Ryland Barton, who's State House reporter for Kentucky Public Radio, as we continue to watch the governor's race there. Ryland, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Well, the House Intelligence Committee has announced today that the first public hearings of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump will start next week. And as part of that inquiry, Democrats requested a deposition from acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. He's not expected to comply, but he's believed to be central in the controversy over aid withheld from Ukraine and the campaign to pressure investigations into Joe Biden and the computer server used in the 2016 election. Remember last month at a press conference, Mulvaney described what sounded like a quid pro quo, which prompted this from Jonathan Carl of ABC News.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happens as well.
We do that all the time, so with foreign policy. And I have news for everybody. Get over it.
Mick Mulvaney is a former fast-rising congressman from South Carolina. Jamie Lovegrove has covered him for the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina, and in Washington. So, Jamie, Mulvaney later walked back what he said, but he said it. I mean, some people would say he told the truth. But were people in South Carolina surprised by what others saw as Mulvaney stepping in it?
Yeah. I think folks thought the Mick Mulvaney that South Carolina has known for many years is a blunt, straight talker. He is someone who is not going to shy away from confronting truths that other folks may be skittish about. And that's certainly true of his approach to spending, for example. But, you know, in this particular situation, it was pretty clear that he recognized immediately after this press conference that he should not have said some of the things he did. He got quite a lot of pushback on Capitol Hill. There are folks up there who actually have taken somewhat of a similar approach to him, saying that even if there was a quid pro quo, you know, that doesn't really matter. But the White House line so far has been that there was no quid pro quo. And so he was obviously counter to that message there. And that did create a bit of a headache, it seems, in the White House.
Jamie, it's funny you mention that because there have been reports of Republicans huddling to come up with a new approach to the impeachment inquiry. And one of the approaches is to acknowledge that there was a quid pro quo, but that in fact, that is not an impeachable offense. So Mick Mulvaney might have been ahead of the curve when he spoke at that press conference, as it turns out. But tell us more about him. You talk about him and spending cuts. He's known as a fiscal hawk, helped start the House Freedom Caucus when he was the congressman. He called out the Obama administration for the high national debt, even though experts at that time were calling for spending because of the economic crisis. And that worked. That policy then worked. Now he's in the White House, where apparently his calls for cuts to Social Security, Medicare, other programs, Donald Trump has rejected them.
That's right. Oftentimes his former colleagues and friends in the House Freedom Caucus, you know, they'll tease him that he's always getting bossed around over there and isn't achieving any of the things that he set out to do. And as he often tells us, you know, he may be losing, but at least he's losing at the highest levels. and that seems to be some consolation for him. You know, he said in his confirmation hearing when he was first getting to the Office of Management and Budget that he understood that President Trump was not as ideologically driven to cut spending as he is. But he said that, you know, he feels like he does have some influence with the president, that the president is willing to hear out differing points of view, and that he feels like he does, you know, have some level of influence on the outcomes at the end of the day, even if they are not the radical cuts that he might like in a perfect world.
It's been a swift rise. He brought down a Democrat in 2010 to get his job as congressman, went on to, as we say, rise in Congress, starting the House Freedom Caucus. He's called Social Security a Ponzi scheme, proposed abolishing the EPA, calls himself a right-wing nut job. But again, first and foremost, a hawk on a fiscal responsibility. And here he is, not just with President Trump, who won't do the cuts he wants, but the deficit is up to nearly $1 trillion, considered unusual in good economic times. Is he being the man that he ran on in 2010?
Yeah, you know, it's been striking that he has not been more frustrated. But yes, I think there has been some disappointment that he has not been able to do as much on federal spending as he would like. But I think he continues to push for it as much as he can in the White House.
Jamie Lovegrove, political reporter with Post and Courier, which is in Charleston, South Carolina. He's based in Columbia, where the state capital is, talking to us about Mick Mulvaney. Jamie, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
The headline from the latest assessment of American 4th and 8th graders is that over the last 10 years, the achievement gap has been widening between the highest and lowest achieving students. Overall, math and reading scores haven't changed much, but there was a bright spot in Mississippi, which made the greatest leaps of any state in reading. Bracey Harris joins us now. She's an education reporter for the Hechinger Report, and she's in Jackson, Mississippi. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, Mississippi is traditionally thought of as a state that scores below the national average. But this year, the fourth graders closed that gap in reading. What happened?
A lot of credit has been given towards, in recent years, the state sort of coalescing around evidence-based practices, such as concentrating on phonics instruction, really providing a lot of professional development to teachers. There's also been an investment by the state in reading coaches that are provided to schools that have a low number of students scoring at or above grade level on the third grade reading gate. And some of the catalysts for that has been attributed to the state's Literacy-Based Promotion Act, which basically requires third graders here to demonstrate a certain level of reading ability before they're promoted on to the fourth grade. And it's almost 1 in 10 third graders are actually being retained this year, and a significant portion of those did not pass that third grade gate.
So how does that help the test scores go up?
The Literacy-Based Promotion Act is sort of the stick, if you will. The threat of having a lot of third graders being held back has caused a lot of school districts to try to strengthen their literacy promotion. One example I've seen in districts in the Mississippi Delta, which has long struggled with a teacher shortage, we've seen some districts sort of rearranging their third grade classes so they have a licensed teacher instead of a long-term substitute.
So does that mean that it would be better for other states that are having problems with literacy to start holding back more, or at least threatening to hold back more students if they can't pass the test?
I mean, that would be a really big policy decision for other states to make. Mississippi is at least one of 16 states that have made mandatory retention laws. But I think, you know, when you look at the eighth grade reading NAEP scores that dropped in 31 states, some of those states that are present might have a mandatory retention law. So there's also got to be sort of an investment, right, made in strengthening literacy promotion and even starting younger than the third grade.
So overall, are kids getting a good grasp of learning how to read in Mississippi right now, or is there still a long way to go?
Yeah, I would say it's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, again, I think it is pretty noteworthy that we have a number of school districts in Mississippi that had to retain more than a third of their third graders this year. And also the gaps between the top percent of scores in fourth grade reading and the bottom 10% of scores in fourth grade in Mississippi, I think it's safe to say isn't narrowing probably as quickly as state officials and educators here would like.
Is there any evidence that holding students back when they're young, in third grade, let's say, makes them better off in the long term?
Yeah, there's a lot of contested research around this, and it's sort of an ongoing debate between, I would say, education experts. One of the more recent studies from a Harvard-based professor looking at Florida's retention law saw that holding children back there that did not pass their third grade reading gate neither made them more likely or less likely to graduate from high school. But he also cautioned that that wasn't a, you know, specific endorsement of that law. But there's still sort of a mixed bag of research.
What do parents and teachers think of the retention law in Mississippi?
There's a little bit of disappointment with their children being judged off of a test. One difference between Mississippi and Florida, for example, is in Florida, children that don't pass the third grade gate there often have the option of presenting a sort of portfolio that might serve as an exemption for their promotion to the fourth grade. And Mississippi has a few exemptions for students to gain that promotion, but it's pretty limited. Earlier this year, Mississippi toughened the bar for passage, and I did talk to some parents that felt that their children were being left behind as a result of this policy.
So as someone who has covered public education for a long time, what do you think the one thing Mississippi needs to do to continue making progress on education is?
I would say coalescing around the need for more resources in the state's public school system, just sort of making sure that every classroom in the state has what it needs for that strong evidence-based literacy instruction is going to be one of the keys to moving Mississippi forward.
That's Bracy Harris of the Hechinger Report joining us from Jackson, Mississippi. Bracy, thank you.
Thank you.
For decades, animal welfare organizations have struggled to help protect birds and other wildlife from cats that freely roam outside. In Portland, Oregon, a unique partnership between the Feral Cat Coalition of Oregon and Portland Audubon is working to create a new approach that's starting to catch on across the country. Monica Samayoa from Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
Karma Crimmins was driving down a street in southeast Portland when she noticed a few stray cats near an old building. The next day, she went back, and to her surprise, a few cats turned into 50 cats.
And I couldn't figure out where are they coming from. There's no houses. This is totally industrial. These cats are clearly not tame. I'm not going to be able to touch them. What am I going to do?
Fencing kept Crimmins from trying to rescue the feral cats, so she slid a plate filled with cat food under the fence.
And then I went back the next day, and I would pull it out and put food in, and every day they were there, and every day there was more of them.
After some research, Crimmins found out about a group called the Feral Cat Coalition of Oregon. Its mission is to reduce the population of stray and feral cats by trapping them, neutering them, and if the animal can't be tamed or adopted, returning them to the wild. Crimmins eventually became a volunteer with the coalition, which reached a big milestone this summer, neutering its 100,000th cat. Cat lovers consider this trap, neuter, and return method an ethical alternative to euthanizing stray and feral cats. That brings us to a big reason for friction between cat and bird groups. One side wants to put feral cats back on the streets. The other side says that just puts more wildlife in mortal danger.
And that's where the debate has really sat as to whether we should do this trap, neuter, and return and whether it's an effective strategy.
That's Bob Salinger, director of conservation at Portland Audubon, where the Wildlife Care Center treats about 3,000 animals every year. The number one cause of intake, cat predation. One recent study says feral cats have contributed to the extinction of 63 wildlife species worldwide. Portland Audubon's approach was to simply tell people to keep their cats indoors. But after reviewing decades worth of data on the practice, Salinger decided that Portland Audubon's method wasn't working. He wanted to find a new approach. That's when he learned about the Feral Cat Coalition.
When I went to their website, what I saw was a mission statement that was almost identical to our goals around this issue, which is basically reducing the number of free-roaming cats in the environment. So I reached out to them and said, you know, maybe we have something in common here. Maybe we can work together.
Karen Cross agrees. Cross is the executive director at the Feral Cat Coalition. She says there was enough common ground for partnering up with the Audubon to work.
Both groups could see where the overlap was and decided that working in that overlap together made us more powerful and better for the community than either one of us working on our own.
After conducting surveys with cat owners in the community, a new outreach idea was created, the Cat Safe at Home campaign, The goal is to help educate cat owners about keeping their cats safely indoors, including using Catios, a do-it-yourself, outdoor, enclosed safe space for domesticated cats.
You know, it's funny for me because when I started this, when this idea was first brought up, Karen Krause at the Feral Cat Coalition brought it up. And I thought, yeah, that's a cool idea. That's kind of cute and fun. I'm not sure how effective it will be, but let's go ahead and do it.
The concept was a big hit. Every year, the Portland tour sells out. It takes 1,300 animal lovers to view 10 different catios, from extravagant structures like the Taj Meow to smaller quick builds like Gina Medeiros' Sunlit Lair.
We built it off our back patio, which we weren't using for much, and it's got two levels, and there's a cantilever area out with several levels of shelves, and there's some ramps, and it's enclosed in wire mesh to keep the cats in and other things out.
Krause thinks the catio tours are inspiring more people to confine their cats, and the fewer free-roaming pet cats, the fewer cats that become strays or have kittens that grow up to be feral cats. First-timer Tara Upton drove for more than an hour with her family to experience their first catio tour.
I was super excited because I had just started thinking like, oh, I want to build some sort of an outdoor enclosure for my cats.
Upton has a few indoor cats and what she calls working cats, which live in her barn. She wants to give her indoor cats more space, and when she learned about the catio tour, it was a perfect opportunity to see them up close in person. Another first-timer, Nisha Sandoval, recently learned about catios. She thinks they're a good idea.
I'm from a place where, like, people don't really, like, would do stuff for their animals like that. And just to build, like, a space that's their own, like, place that they want to be in just sounds so nice and peaceful.
Krause says the success of the partnership between Portland's Fair Cat Coalition and Bob Salinger's Bird Group has inspired other cities, like Seattle, Austin, and Gainesville, Florida, to launch their own catio tours.
We are showing that two groups that work on wildly different topics can find an area of overlap.
For Here and Now, I'm Monica Samaya in Portland, Oregon.
If you start your weekdays with Up First, now you can start your weekends with us too. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Stay caught up with NPR News 6 days a week. Up First, NPR's morning news podcast, weekdays at 6 Eastern, and now with weekend hours too, Saturdays at 8 Eastern.
For parents buying car seats for their kids, a growing number of counterfeit or unsafe car seats are being sold online by third-party marketplace sellers, and you're being urged to check yours. So how? Lori Walker is a child passenger safety training and technical advisor with the global nonprofit Safe Kids Worldwide. Lori, we know car seats are mandatory when you bring a newborn home from the hospital. Some hospitals will help you get one, but not all. So what do you say to parents who think they have to go online because they can't afford one?
Yeah, that's a great question. And car seats are mandatory in all 50 states. And many times you'll find a car seat that you can get for $50 and less than $100 that will last for 6 years. Mm. So it can be a very inexpensive product that gives you a wonderful return if you're ever in a crash with your baby in the car.
Well, this is good to hear because these knockoffs, we understand, are pitiful in some cases. Some are just, someone said one they got looked like a deconstructed backpack, just kind of some loose ties here and there. How do you know you have an authorized crash-tested car seat?
Well, you know, in the United States, all the seats that are sold in stores have to meet the federal regulation. And there are stickers that are on the car seat that, number one, tell you how to use your seat, but also give you key information, the date it was manufactured, the name of the manufacturer. And those are all key elements that are used when you need to identify your particular seat.
Well, but more and more people aren't going to brick and mortars. They're going online, eBay, ALI Express, Amazon has removed a lot of these, you know, phony car seats that look like the real thing. How can you tell if you get one online? You said look for the sticker. How else can you tell?
Well, you can't tell until you've paid for it and it's been delivered to you. So, you know, the recommendation that I would use is to only buy seats directly from the manufacturer's website. But you can also go to the brick and mortar stores, take a seat down from the shelf. It will have the manufacturer's name on the seat itself, and the label will give you all that key information.
Right. And you can compare. Well, and by the way, you mentioned the label. The wording is the child restraint system conforms to all applicable federal motor vehicle safety standards. And the brand should be stamped on the seat itself. If it's not, you may have a counterfeit there.
Right. And you know, take advantage of the 43,000 certified technicians. They are the ones that have spotted these seats that are counterfeit.
And just, Lori, how important is this? You might look at a seat and think, well, so what? It doesn't have the label, or it doesn't have, it looks pretty much like the other seat. Why is it so important?
So if you're in a really serious crash and you have a baby or a young child, just know that these seats are designed to meet those incredible crash forces, and they help the child ride down the crash. I would say, you know, go for the seat that's totally regulated.
You know, a lot of people pass on car seats when they're finished with them. I am assuming that you should never assume, that you should still do the same thing. Look for the label. See if the manufacturer has a website. See if the American Academy of Pediatrics has that seat on their list.
And you know, passing it down is fine if you know the person, but when you buy it at a yard sale, that is something that we would avoid at all cost.
It's Lori Walker with Save Kids Worldwide. Lori, thank you.
Thank you so much.
House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff announced today that public hearings in the House's impeachment inquiry into President Trump will start next week.
So those open hearings will be an opportunity for the American people to evaluate the witnesses for themselves, to make their own determinations about the credibility of the witnesses, but also to learn firsthand about the facts of the president's misconduct.
The hearings will begin Wednesday with William Taylor, acting ambassador to Ukraine, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent. That announcement from Democrats comes after one key witness, U.S. Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland, revised his testimony, saying he did tell a top Ukrainian official that military aid was conditioned on political investigations that President Trump wanted. I spoke earlier today with Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. He's on the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees. And I asked him about how significant he found that testimony from Gordon Sondland, that reversal, that the ambassador did deliver a quid pro quo message to the Ukrainians.
Well, it's pretty significant to me. I remember reading Mark Twain saying that if you always tell the truth, you never have anything to remember. But he had a lot to remember, and I guess he said his recollection was refreshed by other people's testimony, and he remembered what he described as a quid pro quo. It's interesting to me that the president's defenders, after denying a quid pro quo, are now falling back on quid pro quo as the defense of the president, because, of course, the actions that took place in Ukraine were a shakedown. It was far more serious than just, you give me this and I'll give you that. It was withholding hundreds of millions of dollars in military and security assistance until the Ukrainian government coughed up the political information that the president wanted to essentially plant on the Bidens, and until the Ukrainian government confirmed the discredited Ukrainian conspiracy theory about what took place in the 2016 election.
Do you think, though, that this new information is going to change the minds of any House or Senate Republicans?
Well, what's happening is that the president's factual defenses are successively collapsing. And there have been different efforts to mount a defense, but there's really no alternative hypothesis about what happened. There was an organized shakedown by Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani and his little team of henchmen, who worked first to smear the U.S. ambassador, Yovanovitch, and then to drive her out of office, to clear the pathway for them to shake down the Ukrainian government. There's no rival narrative here. Everybody agrees, and we're just getting witness after witness, distinguished public servants, State Department employees, Foreign Service officers, telling their side of the story and their impression of what took place. But all of them add up to the same thing. And so this is why over the last couple of days, it seems as if the president's defenders have turned back to the search for the Holy Grail, who is the whistleblower. And to me, that's kind of like Richard Nixon saying, let's find out who Deep Throat was. It's just quite beside the point.
Still, impeachment is not a legal process. It's more of a political process. And as far as Republicans are concerned, the president didn't do anything wrong, or at least not impeachable. And even the public polls have shown that only about 49% of Americans support impeaching the president.
Well, first of all, 49% is a dramatic number. When the impeachment investigation began against Richard Nixon, that number was around 19 or 20%. We already have a lot more Americans believing that this impeachment inquiry is necessary. And indeed, a Fox News poll showed that a majority of Americans think that already believe that the president should be impeached and removed from office. But look, it's not a question of the polls. It's a question of what the Constitution requires us to do. And the Constitution makes it a mixed question of law and politics. The legal part is high crimes and misdemeanors, which the founders defined as treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors, meaning offenses against democracy itself. It's hard to think of a greater offense against democracy than using the power and the resources of government and the American people to shake down a foreign government to get involved in our election. So there is a political dimension to it, and that political dimension is what Abe Lincoln called public sentiment. And public sentiment is very important here. This is going to be a dialogue between people in Congress and the public as the truth comes out. And that's why I'm very excited about the public phase of the questioning, the fact that the public is going to get to see these witnesses themselves. These people are really quiet American heroes who have overcome the obstructionism and the opposition of the White House to come forward and tell their story.
Democrats want Mick Mulvaney, the White House chief of staff, to testify. He is apparently unlikely to cooperate. As you know, other senior White House officials have refused to come before the committee. Enforcing subpoenas through the courts could take weeks or even months. Are you going to wait for the testimony from those officials or just move ahead with what you have?
Well, Mulvaney is obviously a critical witness here because he was involved in all these events. He cheerfully conceded on the news the other day that there was absolutely a quid pro quo here. He said, that's how we do business. And I think he had to recant it several hours later. But when the Congress of the United States issues you a deposition, a subpoena, that's not an optional process. And it's just remarkable to me that we've gotten to a point where we're conditioned to accept that the president and all the president's men feel as if a subpoena from Congress is some kind of optional, permissive process. It's not.
But it doesn't seem so far to have had any teeth to it. I mean, nobody's gone to jail because they've been defying subpoenas from Congress yet.
Well, you're right. And there are a lot of unprecedented and dramatic things going on in our country today, and we have to get back to the rule of law. Now, I want to start with the good news on this. The overwhelming number of witnesses now have come forward despite all of the intimidation and threats and bullying by the White House. They have decided to come forward to tell their story. Others, more directly under the spell of Donald Trump, are not coming. We could go to the Department of Justice to ask them to bring criminal charges for obstruction of justice. The problem is that that means that Bill Barr is back in charge. And if we could get Bill Barr to bring obstruction charges, he would be the first person we would bring obstruction charges against. So that's not going to work. We could go to court to try to bring civil charges, and we might do that. But as you say, that's a lengthy and protracted process. The other thing we can do is to use what the Supreme Court said in 1821 in a case called Anderson versus Dunn, are our inherent powers of contempt to enforce our own orders. It's not easy because we would have to essentially guarantee people a minimal due process hearing. In other words, we would have to stop everything else we're doing on impeachment to bring someone in and then give them the chance to be heard, to offer their evidence. We would offer evidence against them. And then we would decide whether or not to hold them in contempt. And what could follow would be potentially a fine, detention, and so on. But I would tell you that among the rank and file in the House of Representatives, people have been ready for a long time to do this because we think it's outrageous that the executive branch of government would try to pull a curtain down over all of these people who owe us their testimony.
I want to ask you one more thing. This process, you're coming right up to the Iowa caucuses and the start of the presidential election voting. Is there any concern in the Democratic Party in the House about that, about stepping on whoever wants to be the next president of the United States?
Well, I don't think that anybody is thinking in partisan terms about this. Our impeachment investigation has been a very solemn and sober process focused on our constitutional oaths of office. Having said that, the same founders who built the impeachment process into our constitutional duties also built regular elections into our constitutional duties. And so we clearly don't want to interfere with that when we get into 2020. And I think that a lot of us feel a very strong burden to try to get our part of this done in 2019 so it can get over to the Senate. And we hope the Senate will conduct its constitutional duties by having a trial with full due process protections for the president, but will allow our case to be heard in the event that we go forward. But at this point, we've seen overwhelming evidence of high crimes and misdemeanors so far uncontradicted by any fact witnesses.
That is Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, a Democrat who sits on the Oversight and Judiciary Committees. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
And we spoke earlier today. The House Intelligence Committee says the public hearings in the impeachment inquiry will start next week.
Today, Donald Trump Jr. tweeted out a Breitbart article which claims to identify the whistleblower who first came forward with word of President Trump's phone call with Ukraine's president. There is a federal law protecting whistleblowers. But putting that aside, our next guest knows a bit about what happens when a cover is blown. Valerie Plame is the former undercover CIA agent whose identity was leaked by the Bush administration in 2003 after her then-husband, the diplomat Joe Wilson, wrote an op-ed saying the Bush administration manipulated the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction, which led the country to war in Iraq. Plame's name was leaked. It was widely thought to punish her husband. She now has a new life, is running for Congress in New Mexico as a Democrat. She joins us. And Valerie, we know you and your husband had parted, but were co-parenting your children. We're close when he passed away in September. Sorry for your loss. I mean, you guys went through quite a chapter.
Thank you. We did. Yes. Yeah. Although it was expected, it was still devastating. And of course, our twins are only 19, and that's much too young to lose a parent.
Well, and what do you tell them about that time when the government leaked the identity of you, an agent, in, you know, payback for your husband criticizing the Bush administration's use of weapons of mass destruction to build a case for the war?
Right. Well, it's not exactly analogous to the whistleblower that's central to the Trump impeachment issue, because in the case of my twin's father, Joe Wilson, he proudly put his name on this op-ed piece. Nevertheless, I feel deeply on a very personal level for this whistleblower, although it seems pretty clear that they probably had a good understanding of what they were doing, because it was, by all accounts, a carefully prepared report. Many people have corroborated what is in that report. It was well written and so forth. But this whistleblower, probably male, we don't know for sure, he had no idea how his life would profoundly and fundamentally be altered. And those that are calling for his identity to be betrayed, it's not only illegal, it's a violation of the Whistleblowers Act. It is also simply harassment, and it's just wrong.
Well, tell us, how did it change your life?
Oh, I went from being an anonymous person. I was perfectly happy doing what I was doing, chasing terrorists and other bad guys around the world to make sure they did not get nuclear weapons, to overnight being this part of this public, just going into the maw of the media circus. And honestly, it took me a few years to get over my shock. During that time period, what I recall is that in the newspapers and on the radio and TV, you heard and read about these people named Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson that actually had no bearing on who we actually were, what we stood for. It was so disorienting. I always liken it to falling down Alice's rabbit hole, where white is black and black is white.
Well, it also meant the end of your career. I mean, you were undercover, and it could have meant worse, because as you said, you traveled the world. You interacted mm-hmm. with bad guys. It could have been worse for
you. Oh, indeed. My covert career immediately was impacted, but my worry at that moment in time was much more first for the network of assets with whom I had worked with over the years. They had come under intense scrutiny. I don't know what happened in every case. But also, my twins were just teeny tiny toddlers, and I was very worried about their physical safety. So it was a really difficult period of time.
Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney's chief of staff, was indicted by a federal grand jury because of the leak. He wasn't directly accused of it, but he was accused of lying about it. Mm-hmm. He was sentenced to 30 months in federal prison. President Bush commuted his 30-month sentence, and President Trump forgave it. You're now running as a Democrat in New Mexico. One of your Democratic opponents, Marco Cerno, a Democrat, has said, because of an ad that you put out in which, you know, you drive a car backwards, as CIA agents do, mm-hmm. he says, some people think they can impress us with make-believe lies and fairy tales about events that had happened over a decade ago. This mm-hmm. was a Democrat implying that you're not telling the truth about your outing.
Well, what we found most surprising is these are Republican talking points, and he picked them up and he decided to run with it. I think there's a certain whiff of desperation around that.
Well, but on the other hand, some would say, why are you getting into politics when this is going yeah. to happen? People are going to say it wasn't true. And it's yeah. going to be relitigated all over again. Why do that?
Look, you're right. Good question. I am running because I feel compelled to do so. I believe that Trump and what is left of the GOP is imperiling the values that we care about here in New Mexico and across our country. So when the seat became open, because Ben Ray Lujan is now running for a Senate seat, I raised my hand and I want to serve my country again.
That's Valerie Plame, former CIA operative whose identity was leaked to the press in 2003. Now, as we said, running for a congressional seat in New Mexico. Valerie Plame, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson. As wildfires continue to rage in California, we'll visit the town of Paradise, where residents are just getting back on their feet 1 year after the campfire.
We've come a long ways, not just us as a family, but as a community, as a town. You know, just the fact that we're pretty much cleaned up.
That's next time on Here and Now.